Are you caught in the whirlwind of overwhelming responsibilities? And does the very thought of Monday morning send chills down your spine? Well, it's time to toss those feelings out the window. Welcome to Season 3 of the Take Notes podcast, where you get to make yourself the priority in order to show up as your best self. I'm your host, Jen Rafferty, former music teacher, emotional intelligence practitioner, mom of two, and founder of Empowered Educator. And I've been where you are. In this season, we're not just talking about surviving, we are diving deep into thriving. Are you ready to take the lead in your life? Well, let's do this. Hello, and welcome to another fabulous episode of Take Notes. I am with Chantel Pratt, who is a professor at the University of Washington with appointments in the departments of psychology, neuroscience, and linguistics, and at the Institute for Learning and Brain Sciences, the Center for Neurotechnology, and the Institute for Neuroengineering. Her work has been supported by the National Institute of Health, the Office of Naval Research, and the Keck Foundation. Chantel speaks internationally at events like the World Science Festival, and she has been featured in the documentary I Am Human. And she is also the author of The Neuroscience of You. Her studies have been profiled in media ranging from Scientific American, Psychology Today, and Science Daily to Rolling Stone, Popular Mechanics, Pacific Standard, Travel and Leisure, and National Public Radio. And of course, now, Take Notes. So thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to talk to you and your listeners.
I am so excited to have this conversation. So let's just get down and dirty into it. Why do we need to be talking about brains, particularly with teachers and in school communities?
Oh, I think when you read the laundry list of people who I've talked to about brains, from mechanics to travel and leisure, I think if you're working with people and you don't understand the brain, it's really hard to do what we all do when we're trying to connect. And that's to reverse engineer the mind that is driving the behavior of interest. Now, this is just if you want to have a polite conversation with somebody who's bringing you a cup of coffee, I think it's a great idea. But if you're trying to shape another mind, it's really hard for me to imagine how one goes about that without understanding how they got to the place that they're at right now. And I think with respect to your audience who are educators who are trying to understand themselves and take care of themselves, I would say that you have the power to start with you, and that one of the common mistakes we all make is that thinking other people work like we do. We put ourselves, we're social creatures, and we learn using this mirror neuron system, which essentially says I observe a behavior and my brain activates the parts that I would use to create that behavior. We put ourselves into our understanding of the world around us, and it's automatic and it's invisible. So as you see patterns cropping up over and over in your relationships, you might not realize how much of that is the lens through which you see the world permeating into the way you understand others. And I would just say, like, so there's two things here in the answer. One is, if you don't understand yourself through the lens, the perceptual and conceptual lens that your brain creates, you can't subtract, oh, that's me, that's a me thing, from the way you're understanding another individual. We automatically, instinctively, quickly interpret others through our own lenses. So I think that's super important. And the second thing is that behavior. Somebody can behave in a certain way for different reasons. We succeed and fail and struggle for different reasons. And performance on a test, for instance, or in a classroom, doesn't necessarily give us all the information that we need to understand the why of that. So I think understanding something about not only how brains work on average, but how different brains think, feel, and behave can give us the tools for knowing what questions to ask, what contexts we need to vary to try and figure out why somebody is behaving the way they're behaving.
Yeah, so necessary, and a huge part that's missing from pre-service teaching programs, for sure. I mean, maybe we'll get a semester of educational psychology and and that's it. But something that I really want to continue to go back to, because this is really aligned with what Empowered Educator is about. We have this foundation of the most generous thing you can do for your students is take care of yourself. And what you're suggesting right now, which is so aligned, is that so much of our focus is outward. We want to reach the kids. We want to talk to the parents. We want to get to the same page with our administrator. But what really needs to happen is looking inward and who am I and how do I operate? How do I perceive the world so that then we can do all these other things? And that's challenging. To say, you know, okay, this is a me thing requires a certain level of responsibility and sometimes uncomfortable confrontation with yourself.
That's right.
Can you talk a little bit about how to navigate that?
Yeah. I mean, I'm still thinking about this, doing like reading papers about it and sort of working through it myself, because I guess I'm always like capital T truth is so slippery. So the truth as my brain perceives it based on the information it has access to is that there is no separation between the way we understand ourselves and the way we understand the world. I think we have this one of the most important tricks our brain plays on us is making us believe that we're seeing these objective truths, that it feels like we open our eyes and perceive the world like a movie, but instead we're taking low resolution samples of the world around us and we're constantly filling in the blanks based on what we expect to be happening, based on our previous lifetime of experiences. Like, we are inference generating machines. And the way we come to understand ourselves and our place in the world are intimately intertwined. They're tied to our previous experiences. And so you might think this dress is blue and black. And somebody else might say, no way, that dress is white and gold. And something as straightforward as the color of an object can be open to different interpretations based on people's previous experience with light and shadows. So you think about how that scales up to something like, what do you think of as success in the classroom or success outside of the classroom? Or how do you define well-being? It's just the you. Like, your sense of self is really largely like, what is the common denominator on all of my life experiences? You know what I mean? And we are unable to be objective about that any more than we can be fully objective about all the incomplete information we have about the world around us. So it is, I think it's a delicate balance between learning and having awareness of these things and also saying, my brain is actually not motivated to know the truth. It's motivated to figure out what works for me and to move me through the world in a way that drives success. A lot of information that you're presented with doesn't inform your decisions. If you were trying to understand the truth, there would just be a lot of irrelevant stuff in there, right? So the truth, as I experience it, what happens in your brain is that it's looking for information that's important for you, and it's turning up those signals and turning down signals on things that it's decided based on your lived experiences aren't important to you. It prevents you from seeing the truth because that's not what's really important for driving success. What's really important for driving success is like what works for you. And so I've been thinking about this a lot. My husband and my life partner is also a cognitive neuroscientist. He works really differently from me. And so when I am sort of testing my hypotheses about myself or like some other person, it's kind of nice to have an information partner who says, hey, like I'm trying to notice things that are inconsistent with my ideas of me, because I know that I'll notice the things that are consistent and I'll keep reactivating those things. Will you help me pay attention to when I am really disciplined or something like that? You know, it's, I think sometimes in order to sort of have an accurate sense of self, in order to update your old beliefs, you need to establish a new practice of noticing things that are surprising or inconsistent with kind of your view of self. And it's hard.
Yeah, it is hard. And I think doing it from a place of curiosity is obvious. So we're not judging ourselves and coming from that place of shame and blame. For example, being consistent, my mind goes to, you know, yeah, I said I would go to the gym this many times and now I'm not. So looking at a mirror in that way can teeter on the side of judgment if that's what I choose. Mm-hmm. But having a mirror of someone like you just described, like your partner. So exciting. But I think that's also why this seems to work and learn about this in community so that mm-hmm. we are able to do this. So having a space like a school or a school community where everyone speaks the same language, those conversations are able to happen. Can you talk a little bit about maybe how you've seen that play out?
To be perfectly honest, I haven't, but I think it's really important. So I just read a book called Why We Remember by my former graduate professor, Charan Ranganath. And in that, he talks about social memory. And there are pluses and minuses. And so it's a little bit related to what you mentioned. There's something about being in community, which is really good, and being in a safe space and being supported for testing out these different vulnerable hypotheses about self. And that I can speak to. But when it comes to looking for evidence, like having other people help you notice things that you might forget or recage or reclassify experiences that you've labeled in a certain way, I don't know. It seems like in my life, I have this community of two. I think we could learn to do it by ourselves. But I do think that as you spread the task, you get more objectivity, which I think brings to the point of the power of working in teams of people who work differently. When you have the tools and the space to connect with people whose brains don't work like yours, you get these like beautiful different ways of seeing the world and these different perspectives on what you can become so entrenched as is this is right or wrong, this is the truth or the not truth. Because again, our brains are constantly feeding us things that are consistent with what works for us.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So let's go back for 1 second about something you said earlier about success, because mm-hmm. I was fortunate enough to fall into the type of typical brain that did well in school and collected my A's and gold stars and associated a lot of my self-worth to those things. Another story for another time. And I'm also a child of the 90s where like tracking was a thing. And now moving forward, we're having lots of different conversation about neurodivergence. But the truth is, and this speaks to really just the title of your book even, everyone has their own way of being. And so this one size fits all, we know cognitively doesn't work, but changing this organizational structure is like moving a mountain. What are some things you can speak to, at least start to plant some seeds as to how we can start thinking about moving this in a different direction?
Man, that's a big and important question. So the first thing I want to say is that this idea of like classroom-based learning or good learning or even typical learning versus atypical learning is so largely culturally defined. And also, importantly, is so small when it comes to how your brain defines success and how your brain defines learning, right? So let's just talk about the difference between instructed learning, like if I am standing in front of you and explaining how to do something, or you're watching a video on YouTube, how much of how you think of yourself as a good learner is tied to your ability to regurgitate in some way a thing that you learn through instructions. You know, it could be, I mean, most of us don't think about how well we put together furniture with an IKEA instruction versus something else, but that's instructions too. But so much of how we think of ourselves as learners is tied to classrooms. And I think the first point I want to make is that is a really probably uniquely human, very evolutionarily new and very expensive way to learn. When you think about learning from your brain standpoint, this is, I have had an experience. And by the way, your brain does not care if this experience is real or imagined. So even when you go back and reclassify, oh, that was good or that was bad, you're creating a new experience that your brain learns from. So learning from your brain is, I have had this experience and I'm going to use this experience to reorganize the way I think, feel, and behave in a way that is going to have a better outcome in the future. That's learning the way all behaving animals do it. And it's the vast majority of the way people do it. We do it by trying things and seeing what works. Trial and error learning is how we learn to acquire the language through which we can eventually get instructed learning through, right? So the instructed learning is something that your brain saves for special occasions. It's not the meat and potatoes of how you grow from your experiences. So this is like step one. We have this really weird, if you think even just about human evolution, there's this really weird thing, which is like, I'm going to tell you a thing, then you're going to absorb that thing, and then you're going to take a test. Usually it's not even about, can you now go fix a car or use that thing to navigate Barcelona or apply it to make better decisions in the future, right? Like that, even if we said, okay, let's evaluate instructed learning by not by somebody's ability to regurgitate it or to make it in their own words and do it on a test, but actually by somebody's ability to apply it in a way that maximizes their version of success, right? I just learned about world history and now I'm called to vote or something. And I can apply that in a way that changes my decision, knowing what happened in the past. Not like I'm going to take a test and say this war started at this time, but like I'm going to feel like I make better political decisions now or something like that. It's just so, the definition of classroom learning is so specific. It's not that it's not how human brains learn, but it's such a small way of assessing how human brains learn. And it's such a specific type of the kind of like apex type of human learning that when we say somebody, wild to me to think that up to 10% of native English speakers can be considered to have dyslexia. And this winds up being a huge percentage of the people who are diagnosed as learning disabled, right? In fact, these people have a hard time learning through written instructions, but actually written language is really new for human brains. It's like possibly 5,000 years old, where spoken language is 50,000 years old or more. A person with dyslexia has a hard time extracting verbal information from these like tiny random squiggles that we learn through thousands of hours of practice to translate into sounds and then words and then the ideas that we want to communicate. And that sort of bottleneck creates the stigma of being learning disabled. And then because of the way that our modern classrooms work, it makes it harder for children who have dyslexia to acquire information about history that then they'll use to vote and so forth and so on, right? It's complicated. I guess it's complicated. And what I'd like to say is a lot of the types of diagnoses that people consider to be neurodivergent, things like ADHD, autism, or dyslexia, just for example, these things are increasing in frequency. They're not necessarily atypical. They're just ways of learning, being, or interacting that have been deemed to be not working well in this culture that we have defined as how we learn and with the sort of metrics that we've used as how we learn. But in fact, every brain learns a little bit differently. All of us are trying to learn in a way that sort of maximizes our future success based on our previous experiences. And I think appreciating sort of the bigness that is learning in the brain and the separation between things that can define and motivate success for an individual and what we have defined as a culture to be good learning, which might actually not really set us up for success in all these interesting ways, other than the confidence that comes from saying, hey, I got straight A's at this school. And so that means I'm capable of all these things that really, as you alluded to, your college education didn't necessarily prepare you for in any way, other than making you think you can do hard things. It's a really big thing you've highlighted here in the sort of separation between book smarts or like classroom performance and the ways our brains go about trying to maximize our individual success based on what works for us.
Yeah. And so, you know, this can feel very overwhelming now because, okay, so I'm in a classroom, 26, 30, sometimes even 35 students who all have different brains. And my experience of the world is coming from my own brain and my own experience projecting onto all of these children. So now what?
So I think that there's a mounting evidence that kids who spend more time in the class with the same teacher have greater levels of success. And the reason that I believe that's true is because if you have the same students for 2 years, you have twice as much time to get to know them as individuals. And I think that what's going on there, I don't think about like, oh, do you like history? And so you learn these things. I'm going to give you these books. It's about relationship building. And the reason that I think that's important is that even for people like you and I who did really well in school, it's still hard. It's hard. And it's the fact, there's part of this fact that we did well in it and then we got reinforced for it, motivated us to do the work, to work through hard things, even if we were like, I don't know if I'm ever going to need this in my life again or not. And so I think that understanding each individual in from a standpoint of what is important to them and what motivates them, I think being able to see this person and motivate them based on what you can glean is their reward system, is their why, is the most powerful thing you can do. Like, you're sitting here and you're teaching music or math or history, and maybe 25% of those students have like self-elected into this class and 75% have to do it. Like, how do you lock on to what is important to them, to their why, and get them to be motivated to get the information that you're trying to give to them? And you talked about curiosity. That's the key right there. So once I was in a writing group with people who from all different backgrounds and disciplines, there were like spoken word poets and people who wrote travel guides, and we would take turns writing. And one time a science fiction writer said to me, after I read a blurb from the book, they said, I feel like you're one of those sneaky moms who puts vegetables in dessert. And I thought it was such a compliment, because what they were trying to say is, I've taken something that they thought they would never care about, neuroscience, and said, how can you not care about this? Like, this, you connect it, do the work to, you know, I would hope that the things that we've decided to teach in our public education systems are in some way connected to this person's future success or functioning in the everyday world. But we don't always do the work to make those connections clear, interesting, and exciting, and to understand that they might look differently to different people. So I read a study. We're doing research on self-education and sort of personalizing neuroscience education in our lab. And I read a study that shows that if you give like a questionnaire about interests to a student, so it might be like, here are 15 things you rated on a scale of 1 to 10, like basketball, unicorn. I don't know. I'm just thinking about like different things someone might care about. Then you put math word problems into these contexts. Like, suddenly, instead of doing 3 plus 4, you're doing this many dribbles plus this many points or whatever, or 3 unicorns and 4, I don't know, stardust trails. So as something as simple as like putting the thing into a context that somebody already cares about dramatically improves their performance and their learning. So I think that's where I would start if I were a teacher. Instead of, this person is problematic because they're not succeeding in this environment, like spending the time to say, like, this person's brain is doing exactly what all of our brains do. It's trying to maximize their success based on previous experiences. Maybe they haven't had the same previous experiences as other children who are doing well, or maybe their brains are driven by different intrinsic motivators. Like, how do I imagine what this brain is wanting based on what I see in the classroom? And how do I use that to contextualize and what I'm trying to teach in a way that motivates a student?
To me, that question lights me up. I'm so excited about that question. What does this person's brain want and need? It's so much different than, this kid is giving me a hard time and I don't know what I'm supposed to do about this kid. It's such a different type of question.
And it can change things, because I imagine, yeah. I mean, you might think I can't imagine this, but I get a group of 18 to 22 year olds and I've got them in the classroom and I'm like, I'm teaching you what I think is the coolest stuff ever. And you're showing up with a different set of conditions, right? Like, you might think this was the coolest thing ever if you didn't just have a biochem test and do an all-nighter, or you're sick, or your partner just broke up with you, or there's all, you know, you might say, oh, these kids are not motivated, they're not doing their homework, but it's like a lack of appreciation of each of these people as three-dimensional human beings with a whole bunch of other stuff going on and with different reasons for it. Some of them are like, I am taking this class because I want to understand myself. And some of them are taking this class because it was on Tuesdays and Thursdays at 1:30 when they were already on campus. But you have the opportunity to make them all learn and love it. You just need to get a little bit deeper into the whys.
Yeah. And so can we talk a little bit about motivation for a minute? And can you explain what's happening inside your brain when you are motivated to do something?
Yes. Yeah. That's a great question. So in general, I would say motivation comes from a two-part process. And one is I anticipate that this thing is going to bring me a reward, right? And if I have 2, 3, 4 choices, and the first thing I'm going to say is like, how likely in the past are these 2, 3, 4 things to bring me a reward? And if every time you do this thing, it brings you a reward, your brain will start giving you those feel-good chemicals before with dopamine, most likely, before you even do that thing. So it's kind of like dopamine, we think of it as the reward chemical, but it's really like motivating the actions that get the rewards. It's like dropping these breadcrumbs along the series of decisions that get you to good stuff. And what's so important about dopamine for learning is that not only does it make you feel good, it's, oh yeah, this is the drive to do this thing, it induces neuroplasticity. So even if in the lab, for instance, in the scanner, you can give people trivia questions. And if you ask them how interested are they to know the answer to that question, like some trivia questions, if you know the answer, you're not interested. If it's about a topic you don't care about, you're not interested. But some trivia questions like, oh man, that was my favorite band. And I can't think of that, their first hit song. I'm so curious about that. If you report a high level of curiosity, not only do you see these dopamine reward areas lighting up at the question, you're much more likely to remember the answer because this dopamine is inducing neuroplasticity. That neuroplasticity is meant in the world to rewire your brain in ways that help you go down that path that gets you to rewards again, right? But the beautiful thing about the human brain is that it considers information a reward. In fact, the parts of the brain that are anticipating information rewards are exactly the same parts of the brain that anticipate a food reward. When somebody comes into the lab food deprived and you give them a picture of a cheeseburger or a salad and you ask them which thing they want to know, it's the same exact driver as, do you want to know the answer to this trivia question or that trivia question? So part one of motivation is I anticipate a future reward. And I think this is where teachers become really important because if you don't think you're going to be successful at something, if you have a history of being not good at this thing in the past or being corrected, publicly corrected or whatever, one of the things that we all have in common is that we don't work to be bad at things. Like, when in the real world would you choose something that you suck at, that you've stably been bad at, that's hard? Like, it just wouldn't be a good evolutionary strategy, right? So if you are anticipating not being good at something, it might manifest as, oh, this kid doesn't care, they're not motivated. But in fact, it's because they have this history of perceived failure. And they might really care and have a lot of shame around that. And it's just, I'm going to avoid that like the plague because that's been painful in the past.
Can I ask a question about that then, just for clarity? So then this type of motivation, if we have those consistent experiences, really affects our own self-efficacy.
Correct. That's correct. Yeah. And self-efficacy is based in part on social comparisons with others and in part on your history of success with this thing, right? And the feedback you've gotten. And that's correct. So like, I think that like dopamine and motivation is a big part of not only the neural basis of like why self-efficacy has such a strong effect on performance, but also this idea of a growth mindset. So like you struggle at something and it's hard because it's hard for all of us. And then there's a level of story that you add to that thing. And because that's what our brains do. They make up stories that tell us, that connect the events in our life. And if the story you add is, this thing is hard because I suck at it, and every time I try, my teacher says, do it again or whatever. If the story is, I'm bad at X, that does not motivate you to put in the work to do it. If the story is, I'm struggling because this is a hard thing, that's the growth mindset, like not yet, right? I'm struggling because this is a hard thing, but everyone's struggling. And that struggling might be invisible to me because they're not all getting publicly whatever is going on, or you just can't see other people's effort. You might not see that the person who got a better grade than you studied twice as much as you did, right? But if you say, this I'm struggling because this is a hard thing, but I know that if I master this thing, I'm going to feel so good about myself and it's going to allow me to do X, Y, and Z. Then you are more likely to make the choices to work hard. You know, you're more likely to be motivated.
Right.
And especially if you're like a person whose previous experiences have set you up to like a challenge. Oh, this is a hard thing. Only 5% of people can do it. Like some people will find that, oh yeah, I'm going to be one of those 5% and I'm going to work really hard. But those are people who haven't told themselves the story that they're deficient. I want to tell you one more thing. And that is that even within that dopamine estimate of rewards, there's two sides to that street. Our brains have a path that move us towards the things that we think are going to be rewarding. And I've been talking about that. But the human brain, as opposed to like AI, has another path that moves us away from things that are not rewarding. So you can, and it's separate, and there are genetic differences that shape how strong those two paths are. So some people are really motivated by like potential like stickers or positive, everybody likes positive feedback and nobody likes negative feedback. But the strength of those two things as motivators, like I'm motivated not to make a mistake in public, or I'm motivated not to do something that feels like socially embarrassing or that feels hard. Like the stick learners might move through the world almost entirely by avoiding negative consequences. So I think that's important for teachers to know about themselves and about other people. And I will just say that you can go to my website, which is chantelpratt.com. There's an experiments button and you can actually do the carrot and stick task yourself and find out the extent to which your brain learns from sort of like successes and setbacks, which I think is a pretty powerful tool.
Yeah, so I love all of those things on your website and in your book, all of the activities in your book. They're so fun.
Yeah, I think it is like me search. I love it. Sorry, I got a little carried away there. I'm obviously carrot. I'm very carrot learning.
Same.
But the second part is the estimated effort, right? So motivation is about cost-benefit analysis. Every decision we make, little decisions we're not even thinking about, whether to hit the snooze button, your brain is quickly making an assessment of how hard this is and how much the reward is. And I think that in this space, to go back to the like, our brains are not motivated to understand the truth, but what works for us, I think it's really important to realize that how hard or easy something is, or how hard or easy we believe something will be, and how rewarding or not rewarding we believe something. Like both sides of this coin are shaped by that person's individual experiences. So I have this really salient mentorship failure that I remember early in my career. So when I was getting my PhD, I'm like first-gen college student. I'm super scrappy. I was that person who was like, this is hard. You're going to do it anyway. I was also a single mom. I had a four-year-old. And I just was like, I'm doing this because failure is not an option. And I just like stubbornly bullheaded my way through. So one of my first graduate students, who is amazing, she's still one of my most precious friends, we talk all the time, was struggling in graduate school. She was having a particularly hard time where there was a lot on her plate. And I made a mistake that I think all of us make. And that is I interpreted her level of struggle through the lens of my experiences, right? And she was sharing with me feeling overwhelmed and everything like that. And I said, if this is the hardest thing you've ever had to do, you're really lucky. I thought I was being motivational. False. That was not true. And she said, I'm very thankful for the trust and the relationship, because she said, I know, but it still feels bad. And that was such a wonderful learning opportunity for me, because I had the science to understand that what I was doing was wrong, but I was doing what we all do, which is like putting ourselves into someone else's situation. So how hard we think something is, or how motivated we are, how rewarding we think it's going to be, is tied to our own experiences. And we kind of all know this. You know that they're like, the world doesn't divide itself into people who bad things happen to and people who don't, right? It doesn't work like that. Instead, what you see is how people respond to those things. And I think it's just really important to contextualize that like how bad or good something is not an absolute truth. It's a relative truth for that person.
Right. Period.
Period.
That's
period.
It. Yeah.
As my student who so graciously reminded me, shut up with your toxic positivity. This feels bad right now. Okay. This is my reality.
Yeah. And that's, I think, underscores what we've been saying all along, is the importance of knowing yourself Mm-hmm. Even just that situation, which thank you for sharing that, because I know we can all relate to that. It resonated with me for sure, too. I remember actually saying that to a student of mine early in my teaching days, and looking back on that, I cringe at that moment, but I didn't know what I know now. And you need to know yourself in order to navigate through all of it in a way that feels aligned. At least that's the word that comes to me, is alignment. And so I want to stay there, but I also want to ask you this other question, because I think that's a really important thing. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask it, because we've all just lived through a pandemic. There is a certain underscore of stress that exists in all of us simply because of the trauma that we've all experienced. And so when we talk about anything regarding our brain, I think we have to talk about stress and how that affects our ability to do all of the things that we're talking about. And can you speak on that and how that is relevant to the role that we have to play in the classroom?
Yes. So I would say from my perspective, what's really important to understand is that just like I talked about, classroom learning is only a fraction of how we learn from our experiences. Behaving according to our, just like you and I just said, we did a thing, we didn't understand the thing. That was like a natural response for us. Then we learned that this is not a way to support another person. But even though we know that, there are different ways of knowing, is what I want to say. There are different ways of knowing. This trial and error type knowing gives rise to the energetically efficient, intuitive ways of behaving that are actually often very good. And like empathy is an intuition. That's not, if you learn it, you have like this rational kind of way of understanding, that's great. That breaks you out of this kind of mirror neurons and system. But I don't want to say that our intuitive way of behaving is always bad. It gives us the right answer a lot of times, and it's efficient and easy. It's when we learn better and want to do different, want to override, because that's also where our biases live and where our baggage lives. And we might be trying to thrive in a different environment than the one our brain adapted to. So when we want to use a piece of information that we learned through instructions to behave better, Maya Angelou said, do the best you can until you know better. Then when you know better, do better. And that is great. And it's hard because that requires this really expensive part of your brain, these frontal lobe executive systems that have to come online and say, like, don't behave right now. Stop. Think for a second. Don't let the fastest horse out of the gate. You know, there are things in there that you can use to guide your behavior, but it's important to acknowledge that's expensive. You can only really use one goal at a time to guide your behavior. So if you have three things going on that you're trying to do to override your prepotent automatic responses, you're going to have to juggle those things. If you're stressed, stress eats those neural resources, right? So it eats away, cortisol eats away at your frontal cortex. When you're stressed, in nature, your brain doesn't want you going, wait, let me, you know, when you're stressed is because something is trying to eat you. And your brain doesn't want you to go, wait, let me consider like the pros and cons of these three different ways of responding to a student. That's not the mode your brain is in. And for many of us, speaking from personal experience, I will say that January of this year was the first time I felt fully energized in so long. So I had the pandemic. We had two losses in the family. I wrote a freaking book during all of that. Like all of us were depleted. And I sort of just thought like, oh, this is me. I'm just aging. Like the early 2020 was so long ago. I just thought, oh, I'm never going to feel like I did. I just thought I was just getting old. And then finally, like, I'm on sabbatical this year. And however long that took, I had enough days of sleep or whatever, months, years to process, that I finally felt for this 3 to 4 week period of full fuel, fully leaded. And I thought, holy crap, I have been fatigued, burnt out 4 years. But for those of you who are still there, I am telling you, like, it just came, the lights came back on for me, which is amazing. But within this space of trying to be your best and do your best, I think it's really important to have compassion and understand that these ways that we when we want to do better and use what we know to do better, they're expensive from your brain standpoint. And you need to have as much sleep as you can. Like, sleep gets rid of the toxins in the brain. When you wake up and you feel like sand in your eyes and you feel like the cogs are just turning slowly, your brain is literally just sitting in its own waste. It's really important to sleep and rest. And I think the other thing is to be compassionate with yourself and to understand that reading a book or knowing better isn't magically transforming you into the person that you want to be. And although I have never seen a scientific experiment on this, I feel as a human being quite confident that beating yourself up about your mistakes does not add to the well. We have to be compassionate with ourselves. And we have to understand if you are failing over and over, then you are probably setting unrealistic goals for yourself. Set them back a little bit so you can have successes and build your own self-worth and self-confidence. And then it's just like everything that's good for the body is good for the brain. Sleep, good nutrition, exercise. You might think, oh, I'm not going to the gym because I'm a failure or whatever. But like, if going to the gym is not intrinsically rewarding to you, at some cost energy in your brain, you really need to be like sleeping, eating better, be kind to yourself so that you can have the energy to go to the gym, which will then give you the energy to also like take another person's perspective. All of those things that are not easy for us, they fight for the massive amounts of glucose that your brain consumes every day.
Yeah. And that really brings us back to the beginning where the most generous thing you can do for other people is take care of yourself.
That's right. That's so right. And it's not how we're wired and it's not what culture tells us to do. But and that's another mistake that I have learned over and over is to say, yes, I'm going to show up for someone else when I can't give, especially if it's a vulnerable person. I am so motivated to say yes to this person. They have had a hard time or this or that or the other. But if you're going to say yes to a person who needs your help and you're not going to show up for them 100% and give them the help that they actually need, are you doing them a favor? The answer is no. Like, you have to say yes less often to people who you can truly show up for. Like, you could actually be doing harm if you say, I'm going to help you, but you don't have the energy to do it well.
Right. And I think we know this cognitively. We say, oh, of course, we know, put our own oxygen mask on before we put someone else's. But doing it is totally different. And then doing it when it feels hard is also a totally different thing, too. And I think having conversations like this, bringing it back to the neurobiology, this is your humanity, this is how you're wired, really, I think, leverages something important that could hopefully tip someone over the fence of being like, okay, I get it.
And then also think about what I try and do is going back to this whole instructed learning is only part of how we learn. Others learn from what you do also, right? You can be a mentor in saying, I don't have space for that right now. And a person who I really like and respect asked me to participate in this kind of outreach artsy thing recently. And I want to help this person, but I have these things going on. You have to say, like, where is the spare time in my life? Where is that time coming from? You know? And so I had a very authentic conversation with the person. I said, I really love what you do. And the truth is, when I think about this, it only feels like an obligation for me. And so I need to say no to me participating in this thing, because right now there are a lot of passion projects that I really want to have time for. And this would come in between that. So it's not about you, as what you're doing is wonderful. But when I think about doing it myself, it feels like this. And I'm honoring that, which is hard. The person was very supportive. I took the time to explain it and not just say I don't have time right now, because I think they get that all the time. I think you get that all the time.
Sure. Well, I think that you're right. Showing up in that way, I think, gives someone else permission to show up that way too. And the more that we're able to have these conversations openly, vulnerably, human to human of, hey, this is what's happening with me right now. And this really has nothing to do with you. I love what you're doing. And that's awesome. I love that journey for you. And this is what feels good for me. I think the more that we can do this, you're right, we learn from each other through that behavior, whether we're in the classroom or whether it's with your own kids, watching you do this with your colleagues or your friends or even your family seems really more sticky.
And there's something even on top of that, there's something that I found more powerful. And that is, there are a lot of things that we choose to do that somehow become encoded as an obligation. I have weekly meetings with all of my students, and I could wake up one morning and go, I have 3 meetings today. Ugh, that's 3 hours I'm never going to get back in my life. And I have had moments like that, right? But if I remind myself, like, I'm meeting with my students because I want to know what's going on in their lives. Like, I want us to have this connection, this opportunity. And it's a choice. Like, I'm very fortunate. There are a lot of things that I choose to do every day that I could choose not to. And sometimes I do. And my students have told me that they're very thankful that I'm so transparent. Like, they don't think I'm Wonder Woman. They know I get sick or stressed or I have something else going on. And if I give myself permission to cancel 1 in 20 of those meetings because I'm not feeling good, it lets them see that I'm a real person. And also the other 19 of 20 meetings, I'm excited to show up to because I'm like, I chose this. And I think there are things like that in all of our lives, right? I think there are things like that in all of our lives that become so that we chose, but that can start to feel like an obligation, whether it's like, oh, this is my book club that started out really fun. And then you're like, crap, I got to read 45 pages or fake it until like just hang out with my friends or whatever. And there are things in our worlds that become like, they start to feel like an obligation. And I think if you give yourself permission to cancel it and remind yourself that you chose it, you can have the opportunity to be more excited about it.
Yeah. And you touched on being Wonder Woman. I think briefly, that's this narrative that educators have fallen into of being these superheroes. And that feeds into that narrative of we have to do everything because we're martyrs. The selflessness is something that we signed up for. And it's simply not true. And that paradigm is dangerous, not just for your own healthy longevity in your career, but for all of these beautiful young humans looking at you to how to be a human. And so the more we can be transparent about this, the more we can make that generational shift.
Right. Yeah. And that goes back to like self-efficacy and like social comparisons. And it seems so easy because all of the struggle is happening in our brains and it's oftentimes and it's invisible to other people. And we seem, oh, we have it all under control and we have great vacations and our t-shirts are ironed. And it's a lie, right? It's a myth. So at least some people do have great vacations and their t-shirts ironed. I have great vacations. My t-shirts, no.
My t-shirts are not ironed. I do have great vacations. Maybe they're the study. What's the trade-off there?
Yeah, exactly. We're making this, our carrot brains are making the same choices here.
Yes, for sure. So I do need to ask you the question I ask all of my guests, which is from where you're standing and the work that you do in this world, what is your dream for the future of education?
My dream for the future of education is that we learn to value different things, that we learn to value what each individual brings into the room in terms of their previous experiences and their perspectives. And I think that instead of, if you just really look at what we say is good learning and how that actually pans out to making the world a better place, I think we might start to break apart our very narrow view of what success looks like in the classroom. And I would love a world in which teachers are motivated. Of course, it's not the teachers, it's whoever's defining the teacher's group of success, right? That the education system is motivated to see children and adults and whoever's being educated for the sort of beautiful, different people that they are, and that the work is motivating that person to be their best version of themselves. So I agree in this kind of core common things that we want every citizen to know. But I wish the work was not about demonstrating this on a test, but about exciting that student so that their brains can do what they do best, which is learn about things that they think will be useful to them.
Yes. More of that.
Yes.
Yes, please. And I wear rose-colored glasses unapologetically on my face. I've shared this many times, especially when people share their dreams. And I really do believe the more we say them out loud, the closer we are to actualizing them. So let's do it. Let's move some
out. Yeah. I know in my class, I taught a neuroscience of you class last year. And I started by just applying it to myself. I was like, okay, well, step one, I'm going to let the students choose how they want to demonstrate their knowledge. And that's a pain in the butt from an administrator. It's much easier to give them a multiple choice test. And some students want to do a multiple choice test because that's what they've been trained to do through their whole academic careers. But like I let them also write an essay on or collage or whatever they want or presentation about their brain and what they learned about themselves or do a project. So I gave them, how do you want to show what you know? as just a little starter, at least in the assessment piece. But yeah, I'm trying to walk the walk.
Yeah, you are. And I so appreciate you being an example for that. And I so appreciate that you shared your time with me and the Take Notes audience today. It's really been a pleasure to get to know you and deeper into the work that you do. Thank you.
Oh my gosh. Thank you. Thank all of you for the work that you do. And importantly, for the work we do on ourselves, because it is so easy to turn all of that outward and see what's wrong with the world and society and stuff. And it's much harder to love, accept, and be kind and patient with ourselves as we continue to become, right? Because that's another thing I want to say is like learning, knowing, and growing does not stop in the classroom. Like it stops when we're dead, I think. That's
100%.
My view.
Oh,
maybe not even then. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Who knows? More science to figure that one out. But before you go, can you share where people can find you and your work? And you mentioned your website earlier. What's the best place for them to get in touch with you?
Yes, please come to www.chantel, C-H-A-N-T-E-L, Pratt, Pratt.com. You can find all my social media handles there. You can play brain games. You can see some of my talks. I think that's a good jumping off point to find out more about me and what I'm doing.
Awesome. And all those links will be right there in the show notes. So it'll be super easy for people to get in touch. So thank you again so much. And for those of you who loved this episode, which I know you did, make sure that you subscribe, share with a friend, and write a great review. And we'll see you next time on Take Notes.
Incredible, right? Together, we can revolutionize the face of education. It's all possible, and it's all here for you right now. Let's keep the conversation going at Empowered Educator Faculty Room on Facebook.